I'm Samardi Mas Cohen. Diana Reese thought she'd be spending her life working in the theater, and instead she has spent untold numbers of hours in the water working with dolphins. She's one of the country's leading dolphin researchers who's done groundbreaking work on intelligence using things like mirrors and underwater keyboards. She was active in the campaign that led to dolphin-free tuna and has spoken out against the slaughter of dolphins in Japan that was featured in the Oscar-winning documentary The Cove. Diana Reese is the author of a new book called The Dolphin in the Mirror, Exploring Dolphin Minds and Saving Dolphin Lives. She's a professor of psychology at Hunter College, and she's also directing a program on dolphin research at the National Aquarium in Baltimore. And Diana Reese, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure for me to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you here. And I know research with animals in mirrors is important, and dolphins are not the only animals that this research is being used with. But why is it important? Why is mirror research so important?
Well, the mirror is actually a very interesting research tool because it lets us get a reflection of other minds, other animal minds. And of course, we're part of the animal world. So many years ago, let's say before 1970, we actually thought we were the only species to be able to recognize ourselves in a mirror. And while it seems simple, it's not so simple. It takes some brain power. My colleague Gordon Gallup in 1970 published a groundbreaking study that was published in Science saying that our closest relatives, the great apes, could do it as well. And then that was followed by studies showing all the other apes could do it.
And the idea is that a great ape would look in the mirror and recognize himself or herself, saying that is me?
Right. And there's a certain technique that's used, so we have good controlled conditions and we can actually discern that they understand it's themselves. There's actually what's called the mark test, where you mark the animal and see if they go to the mirror and touch themselves or look at the mark.
In fact, that's the research that you did with dolphins. This is a number of years ago where you were working with some dolphins and you marked the side of their body, and you had mirrors as well.
Right. We actually did that in 2001. It was published in the National Academy of Science, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. It was the first evidence that a non-primate could do it. And again, not all primates do it. Monkeys never seem to show this. So we exposed dolphins to mirrors. And then once we saw evidence or signs that they understood it was themselves, then we did what's called this mark test.
And how did you know that they were seeing themselves? Deconstruct this.
Okay.
For us.
Well, it's actually pretty simple. There are actually three basic stages of behavior that emerge. So if a dolphin's never seen itself in a mirror, or if a chimp hasn't, we first expose them to the mirror. And what they do is this first stage, they act like they check it out to see if there's someone behind it. They show what we call exploratory behavior. They try to look behind or over the mirror to check out if someone's there. Then part of that stage we call social behavior. They act often as if they're looking at another of their own species. So they show typical social behavior towards the mirror. Then they move to a second stage if they understand it's themselves. Second stage is called contingency testing. That's a mouthful.
Yes, it is.
What it means is that they're showing behavior similar to what you see in the old Groucho Marx or Lucille Ball Harpo skit, where you do this highly repetitive behavior and kind of weird-looking repetitive behavior at a mirror. What they're doing is they're figuring out that what they're doing is related to what they're seeing in front of them. They're trying to figure it out, and they generally do if they show the next phase, which is self-directed. That phase is where they start looking at themselves. They're using the mirror as a tool to see parts of their body. So with dolphins and chimps and even elephants, because I did that study with my colleagues as well, we see they'll open their mouths and look inside their mouths. These are things they can't see without a mirror. They look at their eyes very closely. They'll look at parts of their body, even their genitals, like kids do. They're interested in themselves. They have a concept of self.
And this goes back to the mark test. So you marked these dolphin bodies, and the idea was that they actually looked in the mirror to find the mark on their body?
Well, it was better than that. What they actually did is that the two dolphins, Tab and Presley, that we did the study with, that were at the New York Aquarium, I was director of research there at the time, what they did was once they showed that they understood that it was themselves in a mirror, we marked them on many different parts of their body. As soon as they were marked, they raced to the mirror, and they oriented their body immediately that that so that the mark was right at the mirror. They didn't even search for it. They knew where it was because they could feel being marked with this non-toxic marker, and then they looked right away, which was really important because it suggested they understood that they could use the mirror as a tool to see themselves and that there was something on themselves they wanted to see. There was something in mind.
Well, which tells us something about intelligence, and I guess the idea that you would recognize yourself in a mirror means that you think you have a self. And I don't want to, you know, anthropomorphize here, but...
Yeah, we want to be very careful as scientists not to overstate it. So this idea of a mirror and why this is important is that it suggests that, or we should say it demonstrates, that animals can recognize an external version of themselves. And they understand that that is themselves, so they must have some sense of self. Now, quite honestly, most other animals have some sense of self. I mean, dogs and cats and mice, or they'd be bumping into themselves and other things in their environment. So we have a sense of self relative to others spatially and in the environment, but this is giving us a perspective that other animals have a sense of self that we thought was uniquely human.
Well, and you don't want to get into a competitive match about, you know, who's the smartest
animal on
the planet.
I don't think that's a fruitful discussion.
Because we're talking about apples and oranges here in a way.
I mean, you know, it's interesting. When you think about dolphins having evolved separately from us for 95 million years in this aquatic environment, they have social pressures, they have environmental pressures, their bodies are different, they face different challenges. So I think it's more useful to say, how did this kind of intelligence emerge, and what does that form of intelligence look like? And that's what I've been so interested in doing.
But we are then, though, and you'll forgive me for this, but we are talking about an intelligent creature, right?
Absolutely. And what I keep finding myself saying is there is somebody in there. It's not a person. Dolphins aren't people. They don't have to be people. They're dolphins. And that's marvelous in its own right. And it's not more or less. It's different. But when you work with them close up and personally like I have, I can tell you there are somebodies in there. They just don't happen to be human somebodies. They're dolphin somebodies with different personalities.
In fact, from some of your research, you've written about mimicking behavior where you see working with dolphins, you'll do something and they'll do something in response.
Absolutely. And this has actually been reported for many years. I mean, I remember as a graduate student reading wonderful stories about dolphins imitating people and what they were doing. I don't know if I found myself being the recipient of the same behavior. So I tell one story in the book that I call The Time Out. I don't know if you want me to recount it.
I do, because it's a great story.
Yeah, I think it's a great story. I was really amazed that this happened. I was a graduate student here at Temple University in Philadelphia in a PhD program, and I had decided to study dolphin behavior, and I had a very nice grant from the French government that got me to Paris to work with a dolphin in the south of France. I was working with this young dolphin named Circe, which I named her myself for this enchantress in Greek mythology. I was very interested in Greek mythology at the time. And my exchange for working with this dolphin and trying to study her behavior was to train her to simply station in front of me when I fed her fish. And she was rather young. She didn't know to stop in front of a bucket, although she wanted to eat. So I had to teach her to do that. And then in the course of that, what I would do is I would let her know she did the wrong thing by giving her a timeout if she didn't stay at station. And what that was I would simply back away from the side of the pool, back away maybe 10 or 15 feet. I stood up in a vertical position, and she just watched me. So she knew something was not right.
And she didn't get the fish.
She didn't get the fish, and it broke our social contact and the ability for her to get fish. I would come back after 10 or 15 seconds, and then I would proceed to feed her. Now, I was also trying to get her to eat fish that were rather big. These were Spanish mackerel. They were really big fish. They were like 14 inches or so. And I decided to cut them into three sections, heads, middles, and tails. She readily ate the heads. She readily ate the middles. She wouldn't eat the tail sections. And they had fins, spiny fins. So I cut the spines off, and she ate them immediately. So, of course, I had to make this joke that she had trained me in this case cut the fish the way she liked.
Of course.
Okay. So here's the story. So I was giving her fish. Everything was going well. And one day, by accident, I happened to give her an uncut tail. Circe looked up at me, spit the fish out, and went across to the other side of the pool and stayed in an upright position vertically looking at me.
She gave you a timeout?
Well, That's what it appeared to be to be. And of course, I'm looking at it from an insider's point of view. Am I overinterpreting? We don't want to do that as a scientist. So she came back after, 10, 15, 20 seconds. I wasn't keeping track of it, but it was a while. And I thought, oh gosh, I've got to do something with this. This is an anecdote, but it could be. So then I set up an experiment, which became part of my doctoral study. And I, for the next couple of days, I fed her fish correctly. She always stayed with me. And one day I fed her another uncut tail, this time on purpose. And she went to the other side of the pool again. Mm-hmm. I did this three other times, and each time I got the same response.
So what does that tell you?
It tells me that we have another animal with a large complex brain that's very social, that's studying and watching us as well. And I can't tell you that she used that behavior in exactly the same way I did. What I mean is, I don't know what it meant to her exactly, but she used it in a way that corrected my behavior. And she used it in a symmetrical way, in a similar way. And in that sense, it was meaningful. Hmm. And I had been studying communication. And from a communication point of view, this is the beginning of real communication. We're sharing a code.
Is it also an expression of a relationship? I mean, how do you describe your work with dolphins? And is relationship the right word?
It's absolutely the right word. And even scientists, I think, who work with mice and rats will often tell you that they feel a kinship and a relationship with many of these animals. When you're working with dolphins, I find it impossible not to have a relationship. These are social animals with big brains. I mean, these are animals that with a level of intelligence that you work with them and you absolutely develop relationships and different relationships with different individuals.
And how big is their brain? What is unique about their brain?
So their brains are unique in many ways. First of all, they are bigger than our brains. Their brains weigh about 1,700 grams compared to our brains at 1,300 grams, but their bodies are bigger. So we can think about brains relative in size to the body size. So our brains are about seven times the size they need to be for our body, to run our body. Dolphin brains are about 4.2 times the size. Compare that with a chimp brain, that's also a big brain, that's about 2.1 times the size. So dolphin brains are about twice the size of a chimp brain relative to their bodies, closer to human brains than other animals. But they're complex brains. They have lots of neurons, lots of brain cells packed into that brain. And it's a very complicated, what we call a highly encephalized brain. But it's different as well. Their brains, the areas of their brains are located in different regions so that our visual cortex, where we perceive visual stimuli, is at the back of our brain. For dolphins, it's at the top. Hmm. But the most important thing is that where we do much of our higher processing is in the frontal lobes. And we haven't discerned a particular region that we'd say is analogous to a frontal lobe. So it may be somewhere, it may be more distributed.
Let's take a very short break. We are talking about dolphins and their brains, their behavior. And our guest is Diana Reese. She has been a longtime researcher in dolphins or on dolphins. And she's also the author of a new book called The Dolphin in the Mirror, based in part on some fascinating research involving communication and mirrors. It's subtitled Exploring Dolphin Minds and Saving Dolphin Lives. Any questions you might have about dolphins, here's that phone number. It's 1-888-477-9999. 9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art supports WHYY, presenting Rembrandt and the Face of Jesus, the first exhibition in Philadelphia ever to include the rare painting, prints, and portraits of Rembrandt, the great painter of the Dutch Golden Age. Rembrandt and the Face of Jesus reassembles a group of more than 50 intimate portraits of Christ that have not been seen together since they left the artist's home in Amsterdam more than 350 years ago, on view through October 30th only. More information at philamuseum.org.
I'm Marty Moscowane. Today is the start of the fall membership campaign here at WHYY. We're glad you're a listener. Now it's time to be a supporter. We make it very easy. In fact, make a call right now at 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org, and presto, you are a supporter. We're talking with a leading dolphin researcher today, just one of 500 programs that Radio Times produces. 1-888-345-9499. Thanks.
Supporting WHYY, Westchester University offers over 150 undergraduate and graduate programs, including programs in the arts and research opportunities such as the Amazon Center for Environmental Education and Research and the Heat Institute, dedicated to conducting independent research related to the treatment of heat-related illness in athletes. More details are available at wcupa.edu. That's wcupa.edu.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Diana Reese. She is a leading researcher on and advocate for dolphins. Her groundbreaking work has shed light on the animal's intelligence. She was involved in the campaign to promote dolphin-free tuna. She was also a scientific advisor for the Academy Award-winning documentary The Cove, which is about the slaughter of dolphins in Japan. And she's written a book about her work called The Dolphin in the Mirror, Exploring Dolphin Minds and Saving Dolphin Lives. And again, if you have any dolphin questions, this is the phone number. It's 1-888-477-9499. Just spending a little more time on the dolphin brain. As you say, this is really non-terrestrial thinking. Makes sense because of their evolution. But you also say that their ancestry takes them back to goats and cows and other, I guess, what, hoofed creatures?
Yeah, dolphins shared an ancestor with the even-toed ungulates. Cows, goats, sheep. And it's interesting when you look at dolphin behavior, you know, they don't look very much like them, but some of the postures they take when they're interacting and some of their behaviors are quite reminiscent of what we see. But their social behavior and their intelligence is much more like what we find in great apes or elephants or humans.
And they have this incredible sonar system.
Yeah, they have this really marvelous natural sonar system, what we call biosonar. And I think the military is quite envious of this.
Because they can use it to navigate in such precise kinds of ways.
Yeah, they've been shown that they can detect differences between something, a difference between a penny and a nickel and even thinner substances and materials. Yeah, it's also been speculated that perhaps dolphins can sort of view the inside of each other, much like we use our devices to see infrasound, to see, you know.
What do you mean by that?
So that the idea is that their sonar can actually penetrate tissue. I mean, we certainly can do that when we're looking at our fetuses. And the question is, do they really do that? We don't know for sure, but theoretically, they should be able to do that. And there have been some, there's just been some interesting anecdotes about that I've heard about people who are pregnant. Dolphins will often scan their bellies. And it could be that they're larger, but it could also be that they're detecting something. So that's a lot of very interesting things that we could learn more about in the future.
You also say they don't have great vision.
No, they actually do have pretty good vision.
Oh, they do? Okay.
Yeah, there was a view many years ago that because they're such incredible acoustic processors, they have a really big area of their brain to process is sound, and they have biosonar, that maybe they didn't have good vision, but actually it's been shown they do. Uh-huh. And some of the work I did for part of my PhD thesis and the work that others have done have shown they actually see very well. And in fact, their eye is structured in such a way they can actually see through the air-water interface.
The air-water interface.
So they can look through the water, the surface. They can look up from through the water and see something in the air, and it's not terribly distorted. So they actually have really good vision.
This goes back a couple of decades, but as I said, you were interested in theater. In fact, working in the theater in Philadelphia. And then, as I understand it, you saw an article in the New York Times. And that changed your life.
It did. I was a graduate. I had left the theater. I was working as a set designer and at the Manning Street Theater at 16th and Lombard. And I was in graduate school, and I opened up the New York Times to read an article about the fact that whales were being slaughtered in the open seas. And I was very disturbed by that. And I just remember feeling, we hardly know anything about these amazing animals. I mean, we just don't know anything, and we're slaughtering them. And it sort of spurred me on to learn everything I could. And I got very interested in dolphins specifically from some things I read.
Just because they're such unbelievable animals?
I think, first of all, that when they were in aquariums, people started being able to study them, or there were research labs where people started studying them. And a man named John Lilly, who was a neurophysicist, was the first to really speak out about the size of the brain, the complexity of the brain, some of their capabilities, and started speculating that they might have quite a complex language-like communication system. And it really piqued my interest. And again, a lot of what Lilly did wound up to be pretty pseudo-sciencey, but a lot of his work in the beginning was really good science. And he informed a lot of us and really motivated a lot of us to look more closely at these animals. And that's what I've been trying to do.
You've been doing some research with underwater keyboards. How does that work?
That sounds kind of strange,
it
right?
Does.
Why would you give a dolphin that's non-handed a keyboard? Well, it's a different kind of keyboard. First of all, it's, okay, you can imagine something that's about 26 by 26 inches square, and it has 9 keys on a 3x3 key matrix, and it has visual symbols that can be repositioned on 9 keys. When the dolphin hits it with its head, the snout, the beak part of the dolphin's face, they can hit it. Hitting a key breaks a light beam. It's connected by fiber optics to a computer. If the dolphin hits a key, they hear a particular whistle that I designed that was different than their own whistle, that were designed to be different than their own whistles, but were similar enough that they could imitate them. They were within the time and frequency domain of the dolphin's own whistles. And then the dolphin would get something specific. So it was kind of like a giant vending machine for dolphins. If the dolphin hit a triangle, no matter where it appeared on the 9-key matrix, they would hear a whistle like this. And they would receive a ball. Mm-hmm. If they hit another shape key that was shaped like an H, they would hear a different sound. And we would rub them or tickle them. If they hit a different key, they would get a different object, different sound. That was fairly simple. And we had videotapes and going the whole time. We were videotaping. We were recording what the dolphins were doing themselves, acoustically, what they were hearing. The keyboard kept track of every dolphin hit. It was done in a very scientific manner. And what we found was pretty astonishing.
What did you find?
What did we find? Okay. First of all, the dolphins, in fact, used the keyboard. That didn't surprise me. What I found most surprising was the dolphins that were using it were two young dolphins that had been born in my facility. Their mothers were in the pool with them. One of the mothers used it first. Then her offspring, Pan, started using it. Then the other offspring of the other female, Delphi, started using it. And then mothers cut away and sort of took their first rest in 9 months. They had been very vigilant mothers up to this time. So in a funny way, the keyboard was acting sort of as a babysitter. But seriously, what they did was they started to use the keyboard in ways that matched their preferences. So Pan had just started eating fish. Dolphins will nurse for up to 3 years and often longer. They eat fish, but they'll also nurse for long times. It's for social reasons. And Pan was just starting to eat fish, and he started to use one of the fish keys. We offered them first a key for fish, a key for ball, and a key for rub. Pan figured out which the fish key was. He would use the ball and the rub key, but he primarily used the fish, and that was his major choice. Delphi was not eating fish yet. He tried the fish key once, had no interest in it, and used the rest of the time the ball and the rub key. A couple weeks down the line, I decided to get rid of the fish key. Pan came up to the keyboard, scanned, and again, he was used to always using the fish key first and using it primarily, scanned the keyboard, and there were just blank keys and a key for ball and rub. He went away, went down to the bottom of the pool, found a piece of fish, came up with it, and held the fish to a blank key and whistled fish.
He did the whistle.
Yeah. Now, that's pretty amazing. So they're learning about what's going on here. And in the course of the study, we found that they very quickly started to imitate the sounds that they were hearing on the keyboard. But they did more. They not only imitated the sounds, and after they've only heard them 19 times or 5 times or 1 time, depending on the sounds, but they started to make associations between the sounds and the objects and the sounds and the key. So they might come up and whistle ball and hit the ball key. They would be whistling ball as they were playing with the ball in their pool. And they only started, and they actually, towards the end of our 2-year study, they started showing evidence that they were using these signals amongst themselves or between themselves, which was very exciting.
And we're talking about rudimentary language here.
Well,
I never
called it language. Many people have said it sure sounds like the beginnings. I think what I can say from the study is they certainly formed associations that are the beginning stages of how we develop language.
The idea that certain sounds have meaning.
Right. And they're using them appropriately with these paired objects. So now we're trying to do a new study, hopefully at the National Aquarium, with much more sophisticated technology.
And that's Diana Reese, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about dolphins, something she has been studying for several decades now. She's also the author of a new book called The Dolphin in the Mirror, and it's subtitled Exploring Dolphin Minds and Saving Dolphin Lives. And she has been doing research at the National Aquarium in Baltimore, and she's also a professor of psychology at Hunter College. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get some more callers in, or get some callers in, and then I do want to talk about some of the work you've been doing having to do with the slaughter of dolphins, and that was, of course, a part of that Academy Award-winning documentary, The Cove. Let's first get Brian from Pennington, New Jersey to join us. And Brian, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
A number of years ago, I was swimming off the coast of New Jersey, and I saw some dolphins swimming, and I ran down the beach and swam out to them, and they disappeared and reappeared about 15 feet away from me, and it was very scary and exciting at the same time, and they all grouped together and looked at me, and I really wanted to speak with them. I kind of spoke to them as if they were a child, but I know it meant nothing. What is the number of words or sounds that scientists have found exist in the dolphin world, and if you indeed wanted to discover more complex language concepts with dolphins, how would you do that?
Brian, thanks for calling. Diana, go ahead.
Thanks, Brian. Those are great questions. So for your question about how many sounds have we recorded, a lot of my work focuses on just that. We use underwater microphones called hydrophones to record their signals, and we've recorded well over 100 different calls, and that's probably a really gross underestimate. We don't understand how these signals are organized yet, so it's really hard to say how many they use. So, but I can tell you it's well over 100. And we don't know if dolphins have specific meanings that are associated with these individual sounds. Although I suspect they probably do, although we don't know in what way they're using them. Hmm. We see that each dolphin has its own particular whistle. And much of my work has shown that these whistles seem to be quite similar in many ways, but they show individual distinctiveness. Each animal has their own way of doing these rises that we're seeing, at least within the species of dolphin that I look at. But they may be adding things onto these whistles. It's a lot more complicated than we thought. There is some debate. Many others feel that they do something that no other animal species does, where they actually have whistles that are different from each other in many more ways. I think there's a debate going on. I think they're doing something a lot like what other animals do. And just to clarify this one more time, they each have whistles that are specific to themselves or each other, and they actually can call other animals by their whistles. So I think we all agree on that. I think that there's a debate about the nature of that.
Brian, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me see what looks like Bobby from Havertown has to say. And Bobby, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Hi, Dr. Reese. Thank you for the wonderful program.
Thanks.
I grew up on Bonaire in the Netherlands Antilles, and we had several experiences with dolphins. Some of them were, if you just swim on the beach, they, like that your former caller, they would come and look, and then it was as if they went and came back with others. And if you move your hands rapidly in the water, I've had it where they would do a dance in front of you. At least that's the only way I can explain it. And then the other experience I had was with fishermen saying that dolphins would follow their boat, calling out to them unrelentingly, only for the fishermen to find that the babies were in the fishing nets. And so the fishermen felt very clearly that the dolphins were communicating with them. And then the last story, I was wondering if you had read about this and had a feeling about it. If you recall, the boy, Elian, who his mother escaped with him from Cuba.
Oh, Elian Gonzalez, yes.
Yes, Gonzalez. And his recount of having survived, he was on an inner tube. He recalled having that the dolphins kind of pushed him along on this float or inner tube, and that's how he felt he arrived in Miami safely.
Well, Bobby,
and I have been meaning to read about that, and I never did.
Okay, fair enough. Well, those are several interesting questions. Go ahead, Diana Reese.
Yeah, I'll talk about the last two just because of time here. So in terms of your very interesting, thank you, Bobby, for calling in on this one. Your story about the dolphins following the boats and calling out when the calves, their offspring, were trapped in the nets, that makes sense to me. I don't know that they were calling to the fishermen. They may have been calling back and forth, keeping in contact with the calves. That seems to be perhaps more parsimonious or a simpler explanation. They do communicate with each other, and when they're separated, when mothers and calves are separated, there's certainly calls between them. And in that case, it would be incredibly stressful and incredibly important to stay in contact. So that makes a lot of sense. The story you just mentioned about Ilian Gonzalez, I do actually know something about that
really?
One. Yeah, a person I knew was involved in helping him after he was rescued. And what he told her, and I think he also told a reporter, that when he was holding on to an inner tube, he was alone, he said that dolphins came. And at first he was frightened, and then he realized that they were helping him. He said that as he'd slip off, because he was obviously very tired, when he'd slip off the tube, they would push him back onto the tube. And he said that it wasn't until the rescuers came to get him. He was still in the water. The dolphins didn't push him back to Miami. but when the rescuers came, he said that's the time that the dolphins left. And what's very interesting is that the rescuers said they saw the dolphins there when they arrived. Because one could argue that this is a young child. He may be hallucinating. He's been out in the open ocean. Maybe he imagined the whole thing. But it was substantiated that those animals were with him when the rescuers arrived. Right. So, and he said he was absolutely, you know, struck by the fact that these animals saved his life. And I can't tell you how many calls I get reporting very similar kinds of things. In the book, I talk about the myths and the historical accounts of dolphins rescuing people. And they do the same today. And it brings up this whole issue, do they really know what they're doing?
Well, indeed. And Bobby, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Just picking up on one of the stories that she told, which I think ties into some of the, I guess, the social structure that dolphins have. And you write that they will stay with a wounded or injured dolphin.
Yes, we've seen this on countless occasions. And I've seen an animal that was not feeling well, that was rather sick, and I've watched as two animals have gone without eating for 2 days, just holding this animal at the surface. And of course, when we work with dolphins in aquariums, often we'll get stranded animals, we'll bring them in and do rehabilitation. We do the very same behavior. We hold them up so they can breathe. These are air-breathing mammals. They have to think to breathe. And there's a beautiful symmetry there in watching them do the same.
What does that tell you or us, I guess, about the kind of social structure that they have? I mean, do they have a kind of loyalty?
I think they show what we call, here's the fancy word, epimeletic or altruistic behavior. It means helping behavior, caregiving behavior, where it suggests that they understand what it's like to be in another situation. Sometimes we talk about that as empathy or theory of mind, and we hold that as a very important value for what we do. And there's evidence that the great apes, dolphins, and elephants, all these animals that are highly social with big brains, show this kind of caregiving behavior. I do not think this is hardwired or automatic in the dolphin. I think there's enough evidence now that they do it selectively. They know what they're doing.
Oh, that's interesting. And we're almost up in a Reiki board. I guess a tie between a certain kind of intelligence and altruism.
Yeah, I think we have some good evidence that these animals that show mere self-recognition also are showing altruism, which again may be a reflection of theory of mind. Maybe linked.
More to think about and talk about. That's Diana Reese, our guest today on Radio Times. And for a number of decades now, she's been doing research with and on dolphins. She's a professor of psychology at Hunter College. She's directing a program in dolphin research at the National Aquarium in Baltimore. And she's the author of a new book called The Dolphin in the Mirror. And it's based on some of this fascinating research that she has been doing. We're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation. And I do want to talk about some of the work that she did on the award-winning documentary The Cove. I should also add she was involved in the campaign to promote dolphin-free tuna. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Lancaster City Arts is proud to support WHYY. Lancaster City Arts, 125 art venues, all within one walkable community. From galleries, art studios, museums, and an art college, to music, poetry, dance, photography, professional theater, and symphony, it's an opportunity to experience something different in an art scene that's quite unexpected itself. Lancaster City Arts. The journey starts online at lancasterarts.com.
I'm Marty Moscowane. Today is the start of the fall membership campaign here at WHYY. We're glad you're a listener. Now it's time to be a supporter. We make it very easy. In fact, make a call right now at 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org and presto, you are a supporter. We're talking with a leading dolphin researcher today, just one of 500 programs that Radio Times produces. 1-888-345-9499. Thanks.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Have you been feeling anxious, worried, on edge? The Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit at Penn Medicine is studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders. You may be eligible to participate in a research study looking at the effects of natural supplements to treat the symptoms of worry and anxiety. Initial evaluations determine eligibility for treatment. To learn more about Penn Medicine's Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit, 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Diana Reese about the three decades that she has spent studying the minds of dolphins. And as you are learning, and I'm learning as well, she has found many remarkable things. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You were a scientific advisor to this documentary, The Cove. It won the Oscar in 2010. I have to say it's a film I didn't see. I love documentaries. I couldn't watch this one. And it is about the massacre of dolphins in, I don't know if it's a fishing village or certainly in fishing villages in Japan. Why are dolphins being slaughtered?
Well, the situation is that right now the government of Japan tells people the reason they're doing it is because they perceive the dolphins to be competitors for fish. With the fishermen. There are about 34 fishermen that go out in these boats, a small flotilla of boats, and they practice what we call the dolphin drive hunts. And they see this as a way of getting rid of their competitors. What they do is when they kill them, and I can describe this in more detail in a moment, once they kill them, sometimes they feed some of the meat to local villages. The meat was actually put into the school lunch program a couple of years ago, and it was sort of mandatory for these kids to eat meat. And these are local folks, because this meat is not being taken out outside of these villages. The meat used to be ground up and used for fertilizer. It was put into pet food. But the idea is, kill the dolphins, their competitors. I found out about this in 2001. I had heard that this had happened, but I thought it had ended. And after I did the mirror study, I was approached by someone, and he said, if you could speak out about this as a scientist, no scientists are talking about this. And when I realized this was happening and I checked it carefully, I had to speak out, and I've stepped into that advocacy role rink now. And as a scientist, you have to be careful because, all you have is your credibility. But I couldn't not speak about this, and I still feel I am compelled to bring an end to these dolphin drives.
Well, one of the things that you say in your book, and I guess this ties to this, which is dolphins are very sensitive to touch. I mean, any animal is going to feel pain if they are killed. But it sounds from your description, is it not only were they killed, but in a sense that have left some of them half alive and dying?
Yes. Let me just warn the listeners, because I'm not showing you anything graphically on the radio, but the dolphins are herded in to a small cove, and the fishermen create this acoustic net by banging on pipes. And they're herded into an area. These are families of dolphins, mothers, young, related individuals. And they're herded in, and then they're now being tail-tied. They've used a variety of methods. So they're immobilized on the shore. And I've watched where they're just eviscerated alive. They're just cut open. They've been hooked in their eyes. They'll put hooks into parts of their body, pulling them to shore. Now they're actually tail-tying them, dragging them to shore. When they do so, often they can't even surface to breathe, and these animals have to breathe. They're voluntary breathers. Once they're held, you've got fishermen now, and this is going to get rather graphic, putting a metal stake into the back of their heads behind their blowhole. And what I think they think they're doing is separating the brain from the spinal cord. They are not doing this. This is the most inhumane, horrific thing I have ever imagined being done to a dolphin. We've had vets looking at this. And then they actually keep pounding this metal stake in. The dolphin is struggling, okay? And then, if that weren't bad enough, then they hammer a wooden plug in, because in the past, in the cove, they've shown when they just eviscerate the dolphins by cutting them open, the blood fills the water, and you see this red cove filled with blood. Now they're pounding a wooden stake in to keep the blood from coming out. It's purely aesthetic. This is beyond inhumane, if you can think about this. This has to stop.
Is there any truth to the fact that these fishermen are in competition with dolphins for fish?
That's not true. That's the really pathetic part of this. So there have been studies done by a number of scientists, and when you look at the things that they've looked at what the dolphins and other species of whales have eaten, there's very little overlap, certainly not enough overlap to deplete the fisheries. And there is depletion in the fisheries, but there is an enormous amount of overfishing by the Japanese, and that's been known for a long time. These dolphins, in my opinion and the opinion of many, are being used as scapegoats. You know, in our own country, this happened with sea lions on the California coast many years ago. Fishermen were actually shooting at sea lions because they thought they were getting into their, being competitors for fish and getting into their fishing lines and nets. And now these sea lions are protected. The dolphins are not competitors. Even if they were competitors, which they're not, they need humane treatment. No animal should be treated like this. You can't kill a mouse like this in a laboratory.
And is it still going on?
Absolutely. It's going on right now. This goes on every year from September through April, and the government allows these 34 fishermen to go out and kill upwards of 2,000 dolphins and other small cetacean species every year.
You've been part of this Act for Dolphins. I mean, the idea of not only bringing attention to this, but I guess, what, trying to lobby governments to stop this slaughter?
Yes. I went in, I started this with my colleagues a couple of years ago because scientists weren't speaking out about this. And I thought, if we can get our international group of scientists and professionals who work in zoos and aquariums to speak out in conjunction with other animal environmental groups and animal rights groups. Many of these groups aren't even communicating. That's been my goal, and have one voice speaking out. And we're now trying to work within our government channels to get some diplomatic discussions started. And that's just in the beginning, the infancy stage now. I actually went to speak to the government of Japan at the embassy in Washington, D.C. We brought all of our scientific evidence and said, this is what we know about these animals. We have to apply science. They turned a blind eye to us.
Meaning what?
Meaning they just didn't do anything. They didn't want to respond. And it didn't calculate. So we had to go bigger. And it was very frustrating because we weren't getting a response. We couldn't break this story. And it's been covered here and there in the media, but it was very hard to get attention. And I was delighted when a man came up to me at a marine mammal conference. I was talking about the calls that the dolphins make in this drive that I'm calling distress calls. And a man came up to me and he said he had money to make a film about the environment that would make a difference. And I sort of jumped on him and I said, you've got to see this. And I told him about the cove. And that was the film that was made, The Cove. So I actually talked to Louis, I told Luisa Hoyos about this, who was the director of the film, The Cove,
which got the Academy Award last year. Let me get some callers back in on the conversation. And we have Jane calling us from Wayne. And Jane, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, my question for you, Dr. Reese, is a lot of resorts, or many resorts, offer swimming with dolphins for their guests. Does this create more stress for the dolphins, and are the conditions humane, and are there better conditions to do this in?
It's a good question,
and
Jane.
I'm going to hang up because I'm driving and I shouldn't be on the phone.
Okay, that sounds like
fair
a good
enough.
Idea.
Go ahead, Jane.
Thanks,
ahead, Jane.
Jane. That's a really good question. I don't have a simple answer, so I'll let me try. First of all, many resorts, not all resorts, but many resorts, particularly resorts in Japan, in China, in Dubai, in Palau, many places, are taking dolphins from the drive for these Swim with a Dolphin programs, and people are not aware of this. So before you go to any of these things, make sure you find out where the animals were procured from. Most places in the world will not take dolphins from the wild if they're ethical. So in the United States, in aquariums and swim programs, they are not procured from the wild. I can tell you that there are places that look great, but they're still procuring from the wild. So you really have to do a deep investigation. So I would say perhaps it's better to be super careful.
And the idea, if they come from an aquarium, they're more used to people?
So in aquariums, for the past 20 years, people have done captive breeding. No dolphins in the United States that I know of have been taken from the wild. And there's a very strong ethic about not taking animals from the wild. I know for a fact that they just tried to get dolphins a couple of years ago for a swim program in the Dominican Republic from the drive. I actually was involved in stopping that from happening, and I'm involved in a multi-million dollar lawsuit from the person who tried to take them. So, again, I think we need to stop taking dolphins from the wild. That's clear. And I think that these swim programs are, they're businesses where maybe people are learning more about dolphins, but I think you can do that by going to aquariums. If you're going to a swim program, be very careful. Perhaps go into the wild and watch dolphins instead.
Are we talking, though, maybe, I don't mean a different species, but a different kind of animal, one that has grown up essentially in an aquarium versus a dolphin out in the wild?
So I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you're saying.
I mean, are we talking about different kinds of, you work with dolphins in aquariums?
I work with dolphins in aquariums. I'm also doing field work in the wild as well.
Right. But do we see different behaviors?
Of course, you're going to see a different variety of behaviors when you're watching them in the wild. But we see basically the same kinds of behaviors. Social behaviors are very similar that we see in aquariums. I've watched mothers and young together, and we see very similar things in the wild. So a lot of the work I've done actually is being used by people who do studies in the wild and my students. Again, the situation in aquariums is, I think that we have the ability to get to millions of people in aquariums. I think we have to do better. I'm not a big fan of dolphin shows, and I've been talking about this for many years. I think we can present dolphins in a way that's much more respectful than what's going on in most dolphin shows.
The idea of them sort of showing off versus watching them in their natural habitat.
Many years ago, we did gorilla shows and chimp shows, and we wouldn't think to be doing this anymore. And I think we should go beyond this. I think we should focus on the dolphins' cognitive prowess. And we can talk about their physical abilities, but we have to get people really understanding these are social animals. These are smart animals that need global protection. And I think aquariums have a very strong voice. They can have a stronger voice.
Let me get to Kathy from Voorhees to join us. And Kathy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
First thing I'd like to say is thank you for this riveting and provocative program this morning.
Welcome.
And bravo to you for having the guts to stand up. Most scientists and political figures whatnot will not have the courage to stand up. As a person who does involved in a lot of animal cruelty, mostly for dogs in the Camden City area, I forced myself to watch The Cove, just like I forced myself to watch what they call trunking now, which is throwing two pit bulls in the trunk of a car and driving around until they kill each other. It's one of the most horrific displays of, inhumanity to an animal that you can see how these poor dolphins are killed. And my question for you is, Doctor, what can we do, what can the general public do when they go to a grocery store about, purchasing, when you're buying tuna fish or... what can we do just as a consumer to educate ourselves?
Kathy, it's a good question. I appreciate the work you're doing as well. And Diana Reese, go ahead.
I was going to say, Kathy, thank you for your work with dogs. I think everybody has something that they can do. So thank you so much for your concern and your efforts. As far as going to grocery stores, fortunately in our country and many other countries, we now have what's called dolphin safe tuna. So look for cans that have a little dolphin on it that says dolphin safe, and you'll know that they have not been caught in the nets, and this is tuna that has caused dolphins to die. And that took people speaking out. Scientists spoke out. I was one of them. But environmental groups were working hard to get those dolphin safe laws in our country. And now we're trying to get dolphin safe waters globally. So what you can do and what listeners can do is you can write to our government, John Kerry's office. They're in charge of, he's the head of the Foreign Affairs Committee. Write and say you would like them to help in efforts in communications with Japan to bring an end to this incredible cruelty.
Kathy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And again, Diana Reese is our guest today on Radio Times. She's been a longtime researcher into dolphin behavior, dolphin communication, and she's the author of a new book called The Dolphin in the Mirror. I'm Marty Moscoen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
And good morning. I'm Dave Davies here on day one of our fall membership campaign, coming to you as we do on occasion to ask you to assist us in the critically important work of sustaining this program and this service. The way to do it, very simple. I think you know. You call 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY and make your pledge of support, or do it online at WHYY.org. I'm here with Dennis Devine, one of the producers for Radio Times. And you know, Dennis, this show is special in many ways, and I think we show that in these fundraising breaks by really respecting the integrity of Marty's conversation with her guests and just coming for one pretty short fundraising break at the end. And doing that means it has to be a really concentrated effort by those of you who count on Marty day in, day out. A lot of people listen to the show on podcast or rebroadcast, but those of you who are in a position to hear her in the morning know what a really special gift that is to you day in, day out, week in, week out. Please join us in supporting it. It's simple, it's easy, and you will feel great. 1-888-345-9499 or online at WHYY.org.
Yeah, Dave, it's a real pleasure to listen along with the listeners, with you there at home, to this hour. I mean, frankly, as a producer for Radio Times, most of the time I can't listen because I'm working on tomorrow's show.
Right.
We can talk about that a little bit. But, you know, I often catch the rebroadcast late at night, and I know many of you out there do too. But, wow, I mean, so I was just listening, and producer Debbie Builder put this show together. And I just learned that this great sort of environmental hero, Diana Reese, who came up from the National Aquarium down in Baltimore today, she was the person who started the ball rolling that led to the production of the Academy Award-winning documentary a couple of years ago, The Cove, which highlighted the slaughter of dolphins in the Japanese Cove by fishermen out there. And I just think it's amazing that one of the things that we do is whether intentionally or not, we end up bringing award winners to you, the listening audience. So last month we had Lama Bowie, Liberian peace hero activist, in our studio talking with Marty. Incredible interview. She was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize the other day. We just had three of the people that we had on the show nominated for or finalists for National Book Awards. And it's one of the things that Marty does so well, my team, the team of producers that I work with, do is scour the world of ideas and culture to bring them to you so that you can have, you know, listen to Marty interview, and you can get involved too by calling, by sending your emails, your questions on Twitter. And now we're asking you to take that next step, complete the circle, and support that work yourself, not waiting for anybody else but you, by calling 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY, real easy to remember, or go online. Maybe that's even easier. Many people are listening online right now. And you can go online and go to WHYY.org and make an online contribution there.
You know, if you had nothing but a radio between the hours of 10 and 12 every weekday, you would be a pretty informed.